Thank you. Yeah. So, hi, everybody. So we'll talk today some more about atoms. I'm picking up on yesterday's lecture. I'll talk today about sort of some of the topics I mentioned last time that we didn't get to. So most of today I want to spend talking about how to use atom interferometry and atomic clocks to do gravitational wave detection. And so we'll spend most of the time on that, but there was one topic I didn't get to yesterday that I wanted to touch on. So we'll start with that. So basically just a brief review of what we talked about yesterday. So I told you about light pulse atom interferometry, where we take an atom and divide its wave function. So we all have two paths, upper and a lower path, using pulses of light to mechanically manipulate atomic state, so transferring momentum to this upper arm, for example, and then looking at the phase shift at the end by looking at the interference pattern of the at the end of the interferometer. And we talked a lot about how the different signals of interest get encoded in the phase shift of the atom. And this is an accelerometer, and so the phase shift. We talked through how you can understand the atom interferometer is essentially measuring derivatives of the motion of the atom. And so in this case, measuring the position at three different moments in time encodes the acceleration, in this case, g, of the atom as it's in free fall during this sequence with respect to the frame of the lasers. And so that's sort of the accelerometer response. And then we did also spend some time, I think at the end, I got to tell sort of how we try to enhance the sensitivity. So the phase shift, down here, we want to be as big as possible in order to see, or rather, for a given acceleration, we want k effective and t squared to be as big as possible. So we call that the scale factor of the interferometer, because the bigger that is, the smaller acceleration we can see. And so we sort of talk through how this is where it's useful to have very long drop times with machines now on the order of 10 meters, so you can have an atom in free fall for a couple of seconds. And then also, k effective here is the momentum transfer, how many photons we transfer to the atom during the beam splitter process, and that we also can increase. And so that I showed some data with 100 h bar or 90 h bar k of momentum transfer, which gave at this midpoint here a separation between point B and C of about half a meter. And so that's altogether, if you look at the distance between the arms and you look at the duration, that product there, the space-time area of the interferometer, is something we want to be as big as possible to increase the sensitivity. So that's sort of a brief review of last time. And so this is one important class of phase shifts that we think about, these sort of where the atom is as a function of time that's being encoded on the atom, on the atom's quantum state. But there's sort of another sort of category, if you like, of phase shift that show up that are really interesting. These are on or off Bohm phase shifts. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the on or off Bohm effect in the context of atom interferometry and some interesting applications of that. This is a sort of a piece of the phase shift response that shows up in this formalism I showed you yesterday. It's just baked into quantum mechanics, so it's not we don't have to put it in by hand. This comes out in the path phase, for example. But it is interesting to sort of think about it for a number of reasons. I think it teaches us something about quantum mechanics that's interesting. So I'll just briefly review the on or off Bohm effect is a phase shift that you get in an interferometer, but for example here we're talking about an atom interferometer when you have basically a difference in some potential across the arms of the interferometer, and you aren't exerting there's no like local force on the atom. That's sort of the basic idea. You get sort of a force-free type phase shift. And so these are sort of two experiments sort of in electromagnetism, the sort of famous versions of this experiment. So you've got sort of the vector on or off Bohm effect and the scalar on or off Bohm effect. So briefly, so this would be with charged particles. So for example, electrons, if you split an electron's wave function and send it along path A and path B, and they go around some solenoid, where you have some magnetic field confined inside the solenoid, this red solenoid here, you get a phase shift, which is essentially the action integral difference along these arms, and that you can write in terms of the vector potential A. So it's a closed loop integral of the vector potential. And of course, we can write that using that magnetic field is the curl of A. We can write that in terms of a flux integral of B. So how much magnetic flux is enclosed by this loop. Likewise, there's a scalar version of the Onof Ohm effect where you put the charged particle in a superposition, two locations inside of two, in this case, hollow cylinders. And so the idea is once the charged particle is deep inside the cylinder, once it's made it inside, then you turn on a scalar potential. So the potential is zero initially, and once their atoms, or once the charged particle here, the electron is deep inside the electrode, you turn on or you charge up this and apply a potential difference. And so outside, there's some electric field between these two blue cylinders, but inside the electrode, the potential is very uniform if the cylinders are long. And so then you have a potential difference times time, phase shift, and that can be rewritten sort of in an analogous way if you write the potential as the integral of the gradient of the potential. You can see then this looks like the enclosed flux of the electric field over some space-time area. And so these both effects are sort of, one thing I wanted to mention is that these effects I think of as really in a similar way. Sometimes people like to make a distinction between these. If you think about this non-relativistically, it's tempting to sort of in non-relativistic quantum mechanics where time and space are sort of treated differently, you would, some people will describe the scalar Onof Ohm in terms of, you know, just sort of energy changes. So it's sometimes called like a dynamical effect rather than the sort of geometric phase-like effect that you see. But I think they're actually quite similar. And one way to emphasize that is to recast this sort of in a Lorentz invariant form, right, where we should really write this Onof Ohm phase shift in sort of a mu dx mu so that it's a frame-independent construction. And in that case, you can also rewrite this using Stokes' theorem in terms of the flux of a, in this case, the field tensor through sort of a generic space-time element. So I would say that in that language, at least, these two effects are sort of the same character. They both encode what you could think of as a topological effect, by which I mean you have some confined field inside the loop, and the precise details of the paths don't really matter. You can deform the paths, and as long as you're enclosing the same field flux, you get the same phase shift. So in that sense, these are sort of on the same footing. And I'm going to talk today about some examples of the scalar Onof Ohm effects. I wanted to mention that. There's sort of another point that I'd make about the Onof Ohm effect, which you sometimes see, sometimes comes up in discussion, or people will talk about how the Onof Ohm effect maybe tells us something about what's more physical in some vague sense between in quantum mechanics, where you know we think in classical physics, we think about how all effects on charged particles are the result of fields. And yet in quantum mechanics, we have this example of an effect, the Onof Ohm effect, where the potential seems to matter. And so maybe potentials are somehow more physical, whatever that might mean. And I just wanted to point out that this isn't quite, I wouldn't say this is quite not the most precise way to put it, because of course the potentials are not gauge invariant. So it can't be that the potentials are some sort of some physical thing. Of course, the closed loop integral of the potential is a gauge invariant quantity. So we can expect to see such a thing. Or we don't have to worry about that, but rather than the potentials themselves, it's really these closed loop integrals that are the relevant thing. And so just to kind of make the connection between you know these two different pictures, you can think of about the for example the curl of A, which is be the magnetic field. That's sort of the local circulation density. So if you think about a closed-loop integral of A in the limit that the loop size goes to zero, that's telling you what the local curl is. And so so in classical physics, we know that point particles respond to that that local circulation density only. But in quantum mechanics, we can get results that depend on sort of finite circulation loops. And so that's really the distinction that I would make. And that's ultimately results from the fact that in quantum mechanics, we can have delocalization, right? We can have a wave function where an atom or an electron is in a superposition of some macroscopically different path, whereas in classical physics, we just have point particles. So that's kind of what it tells us. So let's talk about the Scalar-Ronf-Bohm effect. So in the case of gravity. So there's a new result coming out of the Kasper's group at Stanford, which I wanted to briefly summarize because I think it's a pretty cool result, where they realized the Onaroff-Bohm effect for the first time using gravitational potentials. And so this is sort of a cartoon of the experiment. So this is an atom interferometer. In fact, it's a pair of atom interferometers, very similar to the experiment I ended on yesterday, where we were talking about measuring tidal forces across an atom interferometer. Here, it's sort of a similar geometry. So there's sort of two diamond-shaped interferometers. That's this upper one and the lower one. So this is time on the horizontal axis versus position. And these two interferometers, if you look in sort of the cartoon of the experiment, you can see there's four dots along the length of this vacuum tube here. So there's sort of this dot here corresponds to the lower arm of this interferometer, and this dot, there's two dots in the middle which correspond to these two points here, and likewise for the upper point. So that's just showing a snapshot of where the different parts of the atom trajectories are for these two interferometers in this vacuum pipe. And the trick is that they put some tungsten test mass nearby one of the two atom interferometers, the upper one. And the goal of that test mass is to provide a scalar potential difference between the upper and lower paths of the upper interferometer. The lower interferometer is simply there as a reference to cancel out systematic errors and noise. So the phase difference between these two basically subtracts out all those. And the interesting thing you're studying is the scalar potential difference across the upper interferometer due to this test mass. And so this picture is actually done. This is showing position versus time in the freely falling frame. That's why the trajectories just look like straight line, constant speed. And this black line here is the trajectory of the tungsten test mass coming in. Following a parabolic trajectory in the freely falling frame, and so I don't have time to go into all the details of this. I think it's a really nice result. It came out earlier this year. I encourage everyone who's interested to look at it. The basic result here is showing the phase shift, in this particular configuration, you worry that this is not a force-free version of the Onaroff-Bohm effect. There are the test mass has a gravitational field that it can deflect the trajectories in addition to causing this potential difference. So they calibrate that out by measuring those deflection phases independently and subtracting them. And you can see sort of in gray the theoretical expectation if the only thing that you had to account for were these sort of local forces on the arms. And in red is the full phase shift analysis that includes the Onaroff-Bohm corrections. And you can see the data in red lines up better with that than not. So it's evidence that this effect is present. So I just wanted to sort of highlight this result, and I think generically these Onaroff-Bohm phase shifts are can be quite interesting way to understand quantum mechanics. And there's sort of recent follow-up sort of theory paper that they put out pretty recently, I think last week, sort of describing how the observation of this effect gives some indirect evidence, at least, given certain assumptions, that gravity itself has some quantum mechanical features, by which I mean that you can think about putting gravitational fields in superposition. That's something that we might expect, and certainly what we can do with other known fields like electromagnetism. We can put superposition of electric fields, and we would expect the same in quantum mechanics, likely, but the argument is, we haven't directly seen that. We have never put a source mass in a superposition where you're generating two different gravitational fields. And although that's not necessarily how this experiment looks at first glance, this paper argues that one can think about that as sort of giving indirect evidence that that's possible. So that's, I think, kind of interesting connection to tests of sort of fundamental questions about quantum mechanics. Another application of the Onaroff-Bohm effect that I wanted to highlight is some work that we're doing in my group, which is to test the question about whether atoms are neutral, which is a pretty basic assumption of E&M, that we have positive and negative charges that are equal and opposite, the proton and the electron charge sum to zero, and in particular that the neutron is neutral. So sort of this is a baked-in assumption to the theory, and so it's good to test it. And it's been tested quite well. It's known to impart in 10 to the 21, roughly, although these tests have been done with bulk matter, so there's maybe there can be some interest perhaps in doing it with sort of with individual atoms. And we think we have an approach using the Onorov-Bohm effect, which I'll describe briefly here. And so you can see sort of the basic idea here in this cartoon. So we have our vacuum tube, this gray cylinder, and inside the vacuum tube, we're going to install sort of two cylinders, the cylindrical electrodes, very similar to this Gehler-Onorov-Bohm effect that I showed with electrons. But instead of charged particles, we have sort of a neutral atom that we're going to split and have part of the atom in the lower tube and part of the atom in the upper tube. So that's the sort of blue and green colored balls. And this sort of, you can see they've been split by some large momentum transfer atom optic. So we get them separated by sort of tens of centimeters. And then once they're deeply inside these two cylinders, we apply a potential difference V across the cylinders. That's the plan. We haven't done this yet. We're working on this. But the projections are quite interesting. If you look at the sensitivity to this, of whatever small anomalous charge the atom may have times the potential difference times time is the phase shift, we were projecting that we could do a few parts in 10 to the minus 23 per experimental shot. So, which is, you know, a sort of a couple orders of magnitude better than the current limit, and then we could sort of average that down and perhaps do better with even more aggressive numbers in the future. So it looks like there's a lot of room for improvement here with relatively little effort, but of course that's in practice not true. It's very hard to do these sorts of things, but there's a lot of, at least this gives one optimism that you could actually get to an interesting regime perhaps. As you can see, sort of some cartoons of what the apparatus looks like. I won't go too much into this because Ben Garber, who's in my group, is here this week, and he has a poster on what we're calling the QMatch experiment. It's out and hung up already, I think. So take a look at that poster this afternoon at the poster session if you're interested, and you can see sort of what these electrodes really look like and how they work. They've been built and tested, and all we got to do now is put the atoms inside. So with that, I think I'll shift gears from the Onorov-Bohm effect and talk about gravitational wave detection for probably most of the rest of my time today. So, by the way, once again, if anybody has any questions, feel free to interrupt, just like last time. Is there a question in the back?
Can you wait a moment, please?
About the gravitational Onorov-Bohm effect, I think I'm missing something very basic. How is this different from like a redshift, right? Because a redshift is also like tilting via potential difference, right? Like, I understand that, you know, this is in a lab, so obviously, even if it's the same effect, it's very impressive. I'm just trying to understand, like, conceptually, are these two different effects, or is it?
That's a good question, maybe. So we could talk about that. So you're saying, is it different from a redshift?
And again, even if it, yeah. This is not to impugn yeah. how interesting it is.
No, for sure. Well, I think that you can. I think you should be able to write down the if you think about this phase shift in this sort of relativistic language that I was saying last time, then this term, this Onorov-Bohm term, would show up as a redshift in the calculation of the proper time along the two paths. So you can think about it as arising from that. So, but in this case, it's a proper time difference between the two arms of the atom interferometer of the matter wave along the two paths. So I think that would qualify as arising from a redshift in this case due to the gravitational potential.
Thank you.
But we're seeing interferometric. They're seeing it interferometrically, you know, with matter waves, and that's something that hasn't been done.
We cannot deredshift that.
Yeah,
it.
Right. But I think you could think of it in that language, yeah, as sort of a correction to the proper time evolution. Any other questions? Yeah.
So given that question. Like we have really, really good experimental constraints on the fact that like gravitational redshift is a real thing, right? I mean, GPS satellites, stuff like that. Like we know that gravitational redshift exists. I don't think, like I think the thing that you're talking about here is not that, right? Like the fact that we have those constraints, this is something new that's kind of quantum mechanical, right? You're saying that there's this redshifting effect on the evolution of the
right.
phase. like the propagation phase.
That's right. Yeah. So I mean, I think that right. I think that I do think it's different. So I definitely don't mean to say that they're the same. But I mean it's clear in the framework of, you know, of general relativity that I think they arise in a similar way. But here we're looking at, you know, the claim that the phase evolution, or in the case the proper time evolution on the two paths in the superposition state is including that term. It's what you expect, though, from general relativity. And that is a different experiment than looking at, you know, the change in the color of light as it propagates upwards in a potential. I mean, that's just a different experiment. But they arise in yeah.
I guess the question is, there's this statement, and maybe this is not a question for you. I should go read, you know.
Yeah, I mean, so, right, I'm a little bit on my heels because like, this is not my work, but I think it was cool. I wanted to highlight it.
It's a question of what does it mean, like, for this to tell you that gravity has some quantum mechanical feature. It feels like this is more like quantum mechanics.
There's a lot of work. In fact, there's a number of different experiments that around the world that people are looking to put massive objects in superposition, right? Where you can then use the gravitational field sourced by that test mass, which is in superposition, to, you know, do interesting things in quantum mechanics to generate some entanglement between, say, two particles via the gravitational field, or to, in some sense, have an experiment that depends on the fact that this source of gravitational field is in two places, right? Is in some superposition, and so as I was saying, that's you would expect that to behave, you know, if it's like ENM, that one can do such a thing, but. Yeah, but it's an interesting question. You know, if you think about, you know, how do we understand gravity plus quantum mechanics? I'm not saying quantum gravity. I'm saying how do we understand sort of putting gravitational fields in a quantum context? Can they be in superposition? Could be an experimental question. And so this, what they mean by this is, I think that that there's you can argue. I think this paper that I showed there shows that. They're basically looking at a superposition of two different field gravitational field configurations, and the energy difference between those is leading to the phase shift. And so that's the argument then, you know, in that language, is that there's some that the gravitational field itself is in some superposition, if you think of it that. But anyways, there's another question. Yeah.
I think it's a comment.
Oh, comment.
Yeah, I'll come there.
And once again, this I think that I'm summarizing maybe poorly, but there's definitely caveats, and there's I think that there's a whole field of folks, as I mentioned, that are working on testing these sorts of questions, and so it's just interesting that maybe they can say something about it already. But yeah, comment. Yeah.
So the comment is that this is related to your question, that currently all experiments, including those here, can be described by in the best framework, quantum field theory in curved spacetime. So in none of the experiments that exist today, including those, there's the necessity to assume any quantum features. That's the comment. And then, of course, if you make additional assumptions, yeah, like that from the point of view of the atom, the world is in a superposition, then, of course, you can interpret the effect as right. arising from a superposition of gravitational fields.
Right.
But that is obviously a very strong additional assumption without any experimental backing.
Yeah, I think that this is right. I think that the claim is in the context of a certain set of assumptions, and that the different experiments in, you know, going forward can start to relax certain assumptions. And I think this is really interesting field that folks are working on, and maybe we'll hear more about it later this week. Let me leave that there and talk some about gravitational waves detection with atoms and start off with this sort of plot here showing the breadth of different gravitational wave detectors that are either in existence or planned. So this is versus frequency, showing the strain sensitivity of different gravitational wave detectors. And The idea here is that much like with light, there's lots of different frequencies that gravitational waves occur at, and we should try to look at as many different frequencies as possible to understand and to learn about the universe with this new sort of carrier of information. And so at the highest frequencies, we already have operating the LIGO interferometers. So those are between about 10 hertz and roughly kilohertz. And there's plans for lower frequency detectors, sort of satellite missions like LISA that would look in the millihertz band. But between those two is the sort of so-called mid-band between a fraction of a hertz and a few hertz, where actually there's a lot of interesting sources, and neither of those detectors really overlaps super well with that. And so I'll talk about sort of how to use atom interferometries and atom interferometry and atomic clocks to look in this regime. So maybe before, what's the motivation there? I guess other than just generically looking at as many different frequencies as you can as an interesting thing. It turns out there's a number of interesting sources in this regime, or in this frequency range, I should say. And in particular, the one I'll focus on is really LIGO sources that have already been observed, like binary black holes and neutron stars. But you can see those at an earlier point in their evolutionary history. So by the time a source reaches LIGO's range, it's oscillating at 10 hertz or so, or higher. So this is tens of solar mass black holes with 10 hertz periods are a pretty extreme system, and it doesn't last very long. It's nearly near the end of its in spiral. And so but that same system, if you sort of go back in time, will be further apart and orbiting more slowly. So those same sources make their way through the midband as they slowly lose energy due to gravitational waves. And so it turns out you can see those sources maybe months in advance for when they would inspiral into LIGO band if you have some kind of detector in the mid band. And the perhaps more interesting point is that you have the opportunity to figure out where in the sky these sources are located. So it turns out that the ability to localize a source, to figure out its coordinates, is arguably optimal in this yellow mid band. So sort of the dream scenario here would be to detect an inspiraling neutron star or black hole binary sort of several months in advance of it reaching LIGO's frequency range, use the sky localization to pinpoint where it is, and then look in that region with electromagnetic telescopes, optical, radio telescopes, point everything you can in that range, and then really watch the inspiral in real time. So that would be sort of a really exciting way to do multi-messenger astronomy if you could really watch the moment of the actual coalescence. And so the reason that this the midband is sort of optimal for localization can be understood with this picture here. First of all, maybe I'll briefly say, how does LIGO currently do localization? So LIGO can pinpoint with some fairly large error bar where the sources are located, and that's how the multi-messenger astronomy that's already been done works. The way that is accomplished is, since there's more than one detector, there's two LIGOs, and then there's the Virgo detector. So there are three different detectors they can use. They're looking at the arrival time or the differential arrival time of that gravitational wave signal as it hits the different detectors, and based on the delays, you can figure out which direction roughly the source is from. And so the it helps to have the sources as far away as possible, and you can see very small differences in angle. I'll be talking about using a single detector, for example, but it turns out with a single detector in this midband, you already can do sky localization using this the idea of sort of building up that aperture sort of synthetically. So essentially, if you have a detector on Earth, since the Earth goes around the sun, if the source lives long enough for the Earth to move by a substantial amount, so for example by 6 months, then you're looking at that same source several months apart. You have potentially an astronomical unit of difference between the arrival time of those signals at two different points. So you're looking at how the signal looks to you at these different locations around the sun, and that's sort of a huge lever arm for seeing small differences in the angle of that incoming source. And so the ability to localize the angular error is given by the ratio of the distance r that you're able to vary the your detector location to the wavelength of the gravitational wave lambda. So that's sort of the second part of the argument. So why the midband is optimal. It turns out you have this. Maybe I'll go back. You have the same argument for localization that I just gave at lower frequencies as well, because the sources that we're talking about in the midband, these binary black holes and neutron stars, they also, or the black holes at least, will be at the lower frequency range that LISA could see as well. So you could go around the sun and have a very large difference in the detection location. But you also want the wavelengths to be as short as possible, and so that helps to be higher in frequency. So you kind of want to be at the highest possible frequency to get the smallest wavelength that you can get while still having enough time for the source lifetime to go around, mostly go around the Earth, or the Earth around the sun. And that kind of targets this mid-band where you have high frequencies, but not too high frequency that the source lifetime is short. So the mid-band is arguably optimal, and that's an argument that would go for any kind of gravitational wave detector, not just atomic clocks or atom interferometers. Any detector you make that detects gravitational waves would take advantage of this. The result of some more detailed analysis suggests that you could do better than a square degree of localization, which is sort of the figure of merit you want to be able to point sort of a lot of the existing telescopes that we have and have some reasonable expectation that you'd see the event in real time. So that's a really compelling, one really compelling reason to do a gravitational wave detection in the mid-band. And it looks like, you know, in terms of, you know, where the atom could help, that's a place where atom interferometry could work quite well. So there's a number of groups around the world that have started to develop this approach. So building a larger scale version of the atom interferometers that I've talked about so far, scaling things up to hundreds of meters and eventually to kilometer scale, similar to LIGO. I've got four examples here. There's a project in France called MIGA that's underway already. There's a UK project called ION that's actually collaborates closely with MAGIS, which I'll tell you more about. MAGIS is the sort of a US version of that my group is working on. There's also ZYGA, which is in China, and then this sort of ELGAR proposal in Europe. So there's a number of sort of groups that have done analysis and thinking through, and in fact, several of these are already under construction. So it's kind of a new field that's starting up in sort of long baseline atomic sensors for gravitational wave detection. I should say now, you know, the work we're all of these groups are doing, and certainly the work I'll tell you about, is all sort of in the pathfinder stage. So we're trying to scale up these devices from sort of the tabletop scale to something you know, approaching eventually the LIGO scale, and we won't get there in one step. It'll have to be multiple steps. So I'll show you about the first steps we've been taking today. Before I go any further, though, let me say a little bit more about the principle that these atoms will use to detect gravitational waves. It's very similar to how LIGO works. The very basic idea is if you want to detect gravitational waves, one way to do it is to take some test masses, which are these little black dots here, and put them on free fall trajectories, so they're following geodesics. So you need to isolate them very well from everything else, so they're just in free fall. And then if you measure, if you, for example, send light between these two test masses, and you can measure the light travel time between them, that light travel time will encode the proper distance between them, L, and if there's a gravitational wave coming by, it will cause that distance to modulate. And so what we mean by detecting gravitational wave is seeing this sort of small modulation in the distance between them as, for example, realized by a radar ranging distance measurement, like a light travel time. That's how LIGO works. They have, in each of their arms, they have these test masses that are well isolated using sort of these pendulums. They're vibrationally isolated so that they're as much as possible not shaking from anything like the ground or whatever. And so you have these more or less freely falling test masses, and then you send light and bounce back and forth between them to measure the light travel time. Now, of course, LIGO is shaped like an L, and all I'm talking about is so far is one arm of LIGO. And I want to emphasize that in principle, that's all that's necessary to detect gravitational waves, is that light travel time variation. And so you could build LIGO with one arm in principle. But of course, they don't. And so the reason for that actually is that it turns out the laser requirement would be too difficult. If you had a perfect laser and you could use that to measure that distance, you might imagine realizing this experiment. But since the lasers we have phase noise on them, you would not be able to distinguish fluctuations in the phase of the laser from fluctuations in the light travel time due to gravitational waves. And so there's this very, very nice technical solution that they have for that, which is to build this Michelson geometry, where you have two arms at right angles. And so then this beam splitter here splits the light along two paths, And so whatever noise is on the laser is going to be sent down both paths. And then you then are subtracting those two light travel times when you look at this interference of those two paths at the detector. And so essentially it's a differential measurement in the light travel time along the two paths, which cancels the noise to leading order. And that works because gravitational waves are sort of a quadrupolar oscillation, so they stretch one arm while shrinking the other. And so the fact that you get sort of a factor of two in the signal when you subtract the two arms. But the key reason for subtracting those arms is not to get that factor of two, but rather to suppress this laser noise. So, but I'll come back to this in a minute, this idea that in principle only one arm is required, and that's something that we'll take advantage of in the atom interferometer approach, where we'll use a different strategy to suppress the noise of the laser rather than using sort of an auxiliary baseline. So let me sort of shift then into the atom approach, kind of. So I'll tell you about, I've already mentioned the acronym before, so we call this approach MAGIS, the matter wave atomic interferometric gradiometer interferometric sensor, MAGIS. And the basic principle of MAGIS, the concept is to sort of use atoms to realize the two ingredients I just described that you need to detect gravitational waves. So you need, first of all, you need some inertial references. You need those black blobs that are freely falling test particles. The atoms can serve as those. We have atoms in our vacuum chamber that are freely falling and well isolated and act as good inertial references. And the other thing you need is you need some way to measure the light travel time between these two test masses. And for that, we can take advantage of the fact that atoms can be clocks, that atoms can be very good clocks. As I said last time, best clocks in the world, one part in 10 to the 18. Frequency error. So we can leverage that as well. So we'll use the atom both as the inertial reference particle and also as the object to encode the light travel time. So I like to say that the atoms are in some sense an active proof mass compared to the sort of the passive classical proof masses that you use in LIGO, where we're going to essentially use the atomic coherence, the sort of timekeeping ability of the atom, to suppress laser noise, as we'll see. But before I say more about that, let me give you a sort of a little cartoon version of how you can use an atomic clock or an atom interferometer. And as we said last time, these are very closely related technologies. How we could use, for example, an atomic clock to measure the light travel time variation due to gravitational waves. So I'm going to come back to this two-level atom and think about an atomic clock sequence. We did the phase shift analysis of an atomic clock last time. I showed how you get, for a Ramsey sequence, pi over 2, how you can generate a phase that depends on the frequency difference between your laser and the internal atomic energy level. That's how you make a clock. So we're going to basically do the same sequence here, so a two-pole sequence. And so I've got sort of these cartoon pictures. These are atoms on each side, and we've got a little clock face on there to represent the phase evolved by the atom. And so we'll start off by to start the clock, we need the first beam splitter pulse. So we'll send a pulse of light across the baseline. So these atoms are in two different locations, so you can see it takes some time for the pulse of light to travel across the baseline. And when the pulse of light hits each atom, it's going to drive the atom into a superposition of the ground and the excited state. So that's our pi over 2 pulse. And then we'll wait some time, t, sort of the sort of interrogation time, and the atoms will evolve freely. And so the phase will accumulate on these two clocks because of the energy difference between these two atomic energy levels. And so at some later time t, we want to stop the clock, so we send a second pi over 2 pulse across the baseline, and that's going to going to give us our interference pattern. And at the moment of that pulse, we're going to have some phase shift, in this case omega A, the energy difference times the drift time, big T. And so in this picture, you can see the phase shift is the same for these two clocks, since nothing interesting happened. Now, I'll point out, you know, when the clocks started and stopped was slightly different because the light had to travel across the baseline, but the total evolution time along each clock was the same. However, if a gravitational wave comes by during this drift time and space is stretched by a little bit, let's say, then it's going to take longer for the second pulse to cross the baseline than it did for the first pulse to cross. And during that extra time, delta t, this far clock will keep ticking, and it'll evolve a little bit more phase, and that phase will depend on the strain of the gravitational wave. So that's how you can use a pair of clocks to detect a variation in the light travel time. So I haven't said anything about laser noise yet, and so that's very important. And I guess I'll say it now, but I'll go into a bit more detail. The key idea here is that this laser is no better, let's say, than the laser that LIGO has. We have to worry about the noise that laser has. And recall that the phase of the laser is encoded onto the atomic state. We call that the laser phase in this calculation formalism. This is basically the propagation phase in that language. So the laser phase is going to be encoded on the atom. And so we would worry that if the laser's phase is uncertain, if there's some technical noise on that, it would obscure the measurement. The key idea is that this is a difference of phase, that we're going to look at the phase difference between these two clocks. And to the degree that the phase of that pulse is common between the two clocks, the noise can cancel. And so this is what I mean by it's an active proof mass. The phase will be imprinted onto each clock. This technical laser phase will be imprinted onto those two clocks. But when we take the difference of those, they sort of remember what that phase is, and we can subtract it off. I'll say more about that maybe in a minute. So this is a bit more in detail. So I showed a clock sequence, a two-pulse sequence. We can also use sort of Mach-Zehnder three-pulse sequences, which is what this cartoon is showing. The reason you want to do that, why you might want to do that, there's a number of reasons, but one easy one to keep in mind is, as we know, the clock is going to depend on the Doppler shift of the atom in addition to any gravitational wave stuff. So if the atoms are moving, we'll encode that, and this sort of gradient or this sort of accelerometer sequence will subtract off that velocity sensitivity. So we can be a little bit less sensitive to initial conditions, for example, in an accelerometer versus a clock. So that's one reason to think about this in an atom interferometer context. You can start thinking about suppressing certain kinematic phase shifts that you don't want. We need to do single photon transitions to make this work. And that's a key thing that I will definitely mention again in a few slides. I think I said it yesterday too, that there's a surprising difference between the different styles of atom optics, the sort of two photon versus one photon atom optics. And so the picture we've been talking about so far is all with a two-level system and with light resonant with that transition, and that's actually, it turns out to be a critical thing. So that means we need to use some atom like strontium or some other atom where you have an excited state that can live for a long time. So you need to be able to put the atom in the superposition of these two ground excited states and let it persist for multiple seconds to measure that phase. So that's another key ingredient. And then the phase shift, which we sort of just walked through roughly last time, you can see in this picture, it's a bit complicated. Maybe I'll say a bit more. So this is showing, once again, the height. So this is our experiment. We've got two clouds of atoms that are going to act like the clocks, one at z1, one at z2. And then versus time, I'm going to make an atom interferometer by sending light pulses, in this case, sometimes from this direction and sometimes from that direction. And you can see that the different states are shown in color. So the red state is the excited state. And so the difference in the phase between these is non-zero because the lower interferometer, for example, accumulates more phase during this part than the upper interferometer because of where they are with respect to the different laser sources. And if you work through sort of the size of that, it's basically just the tick rate omega A times the light travel time back and forth across the baseline is roughly speaking what the phase shift along each of these red segments are. And so that's sort of the size of the effect. And so that actually tells you that if the baseline L is fluctuating, you can see that as a phase fluctuation. So that's a gravitational wave if you have some h times L fluctuation in the baseline. But also, it turns out for free, the same exact experiment can look for things like dark matter. And we've already heard today, we heard from the first talk today about sort of scalar dark matter, and yesterday as well. And so this is sort of I have in mind the kind of field-like or wave-like dark matter, and they can cause fluctuations in, as we'll see, the energy of the atom, and that we could also look for in this. And so to be a bit more concrete about how those fluctuations arise. So once again, if you have some sort of, for example, a scalar dark matter field, this is the free field part of the Lagrangian, as we were we've already heard a number of times this during the school, you can expect solutions to that that look like a classically oscillating field with some field amplitude phi oscillating at the frequency given by the mass of the scalar field, the mass of the particle m phi. Where this is given by the dark matter density, as I've said. And so if this scalar is coupled to the standard model, for example, if it's coupled to the electron, then that can cause variations in the atomic structure. It can cause fluctuations in let's say the mass of the electron is one way to talk about that. And so then this sort of two-level system that I've been assuming here won't just have constant energy levels, but rather these energy levels will wiggle a little bit by the depending on the amplitude of the dark matter at a frequency given by the mass of the dark matter field. And so that same interferometer geometry that I showed that can look for fluctuations in baseline length, if the baseline is fixed, we can use it to look for fluctuations in the tick rate of the clock. So you get sort of it's a two for one. So I'll say a little bit more about the single photon versus two photon, since it's pretty fundamental to how the concept works. So this is apologies again for this messy diagram. There's lots of photons flying around here. I think I might have shown this yesterday or something like it. So what I've shown here is two different space-time diagrams for a pair of atom interferometers, very much like this configuration that I have in mind, where we have an atom at two different locations, so at zero and at L, or at x1 and at x2, and we're making these two different diamonds in each case, atom interferometers, and we're going to compare the phase of those two. That's the experiment. And then the only difference between the diagram on the left and on the right is the style of atom optics that are being used. So this is a two-photon transition, like a Raman transition, that you would do in an alkali atom, the kind of a traditional atom interferometry, and then versus a sort of a single-photon atom optic on a two-level transition, like we would have in an atom like strontium, as I was just showing. And the key difference is that in order to get a two-photon transition to work, as I showed last time, at a given interaction node, you need to have, where you're, for example, applying the Beamsteader pulse, you have to have both a red and a purple photon incident on that point in order to drive the two-photon transition. And what that means is that if you think about pulses coming from lasers on either side, the pulse on the right had to leave at a particular time in order to reach that this interaction point. And so the fact that you're sort of pulling these, and in fact, actually the key thing I should say, that if you look at the difference between these two interferometers, so the interferometer on the left versus the one on the right, there's different purple photons involved to drive the transition, right? So, and this is just a basic consequence of the finite speed of light, right? It takes some time for this red photon to cross the path, and so we had to send these purple photons at slightly different times. And that slight time difference turns out to be enough to spoil the differential measurement that we want to do, because the laser isn't perfect, and if it has noise, the laser phase might be slightly different at these two different emission times. And that means that if I ultimately am trying to suppress the technical noise by taking the phase difference between these atom interferometers, the encoded phase will be different between the two. So I will have imperfect noise cancellation. It doesn't seem like it'd be very much, but we're looking for extremely small effects here. And it turns out the stability you would need, delta F over F, or delta omega over omega in the laser, is at the level of the strain you're trying to look for. So a part in 10 to the 20. And that's much better than we can build lasers for. That's why LIGO has to do this differential measurement. So that's very challenging. Whereas in the single photon geometry, you can see we're driving transitions. I'm driving transitions from both the left side and the right side. So I've got black photons propagating to the left and gray photons propagating to the right and gray photons propagating to the left. But any given pulse, once it leaves the laser and travels across the baseline, is going to be very, very common to the two interferometers. Basically, these paths, since they're, I'm drawing here null geodesics for the photon path, the null geodesic is a line of constant phase. So whatever phase this pulse of light has when it leaves the laser, it's the same phase at every point along this line. And so these two interferometers will encode the same phase due to that. And so in the differential measurement, you could hope that it could be suppressed. So that lets you do the sort of a single baseline approach, and that's what we plan to do with this Mages configuration. Sure.
So I think you all of these are in the fountain, right, when you're doing this?
Yeah.
So that means that the two atoms don't necessarily have exactly the same speed, right? Do you have to worry about like the laser being exactly tuned with one, but there being a small Doppler shift with the other guy, and so they're slightly you know, some slight detuning, this might impart some noise. It seems like.
Well, that might so be a I mean, we want them to be the same velocity as much as possible, and we can so we launch them with the same initial velocity as to the degree that we can. But they might not be perfect, is what you're saying. Yeah, and so and
asking,
I agree.
They
might
need be, to be,
but they're very close. But they won't be exactly the same velocity. Yes. Yeah.
So they don't need to be the same velocity to one part in 10 to the 20.
No, they okay. don't. Yeah, the difference in but it's true that the difference in velocity actually is the so this story of laser noise cancellation isn't perfect. Nothing's perfect, right? So if you think I don't have a maybe I can't go into the details of this, but the first correction to this is proportional to the velocity difference. Yeah, so if you have a differential velocity, then the phase suppression isn't perfect. It's for the sort of typical errors, like even if you imagine sort of meter per second type velocity difference, it's still suppressed by substantially, like more than enough, basically. So it looks to be tractable. But you would want to control that relative velocity. And if the relative velocity starts getting big, then yeah, you are going to be sensitive to sort of a differential phase. Yeah, it essentially. If these paths are you know if one of these is that it has some slope because it has some velocity then you can imagine then the noise cancellation isn't exactly perfect but anyways maybe we can talk more about the details of that if you're interested but I don't have it on this diagram but yeah
thank you
okay so. I'll tell you about the status of this MAGIS program. So as I said, we want to eventually scale these devices up to LIGO scale. You want to be, it turns out, kilometer scale or longer to see gravitational waves. And right now, all the interferometers that have been built are at sort of the 10 meter scale. That's the biggest we've been able to build so far. And I realize now we're kind of stretching the definition of tabletop quite a bit. So we're maybe no longer barely fitting in the context of the conference, but we're tabletop in spirit because we're still using tabletop techniques, but we're building this 100 meter scale atom interferometer now at Fermilab, which we call MAGIS 100, and it's sort of a pathfinder for this. So there's why at Fermilab. Well, there's this sort of this nice existing 100 meter shaft on campus there that is part of a sort of the neutrino campus. And we can put our atom interferometer along the length of this shaft. So you can see the vacuum pipe running the length here that we're going to use for atom interferometer baseline. And then these sort of these three atom sources along the length is where we'll introduce the atoms. And that allows us to do this sort of this gradiometer or this MAGIS geometry. We have two test masses separated by a large baseline. In fact, we'll have three atom sources, and that gives us a lot of flexibility to try different configurations. So this detector won't be sensitive enough to detect gravitational waves unless there's something truly unexpected. So I don't anticipate that really, but it can also look for dark matter, as we said. And so we have a couple different modes we can use to detect dark matter, including the scalar particle search that I mentioned. But also, it's possible to look for sort of fifth-fourth style dark matter, or sort of you can look for differential accelerations between different isotopes of atoms. And so we have a variety of different dark matter searches that we can do that will already be able to break new ground. And finally, kind of in the spirit of these large delocalized states that I showed yesterday, sort of splitting atoms by large distances, this long drop time will let us push the limits of that even further. So we could, do multiple meters potentially of wave packet separation to kind of, push quantum mechanics into this interesting new macroscopic human scale wave function regime. So this is kind of what the design looks like of that. So this is the shaft location. You can see this is a picture looking down the 100 meter shaft, which is kind of a frightening thing to do, I can say. You can see some light at the very bottom here. It's a bit disorienting. And the atom interferometer is going to be bolted right to the wall here, kind of next to this duct. So not not an amazingly beautiful location, but it's in my mind a perfect place to stash an atom interferometer on this long shaft. And so you can see another cartoon of that here. And this is what the sort of the top of the system looks like. You can see the top of the shaft here with the vacuum system installed. And then we have a laser lab nearby that we generate the atom interferometer laser light, and that's sent over in a vacuum pipe over to the baseline. see a picture of what the atom source is going to look like. We've built a couple of these at Stanford as prototypes, and they're functional. We're going to make three more for Magus. This is kind of a picture of what we call the modular section. So the 100-meter baseline is made in sort of 5-meter-long segments, and it's bolted. Each one is then bolted to the wall. And so these are the design of these is such that they can be lowered down with a crane one at a time and put together. So then that design is pretty mature now. I thought I would mention a couple of the technical problems that we are working on solving for Magus, including how do we get the atoms going, how do we launch them with their initial trajectory, and plus as a way to kind of show off a little bit of more of the details of the Magus design. So this is a zoomed in region of one of the areas where the atom sources are connected. And so you can see, actually the atom source is not shown, but it would be a box sort of off to the side here, and it's not shown here. So there's some atom source off to the left here, or I guess off to the right, sorry, and we have to translate the atoms horizontally into this vacuum chamber, which we call the connection node, and that chamber has a bunch of viewports here. We can use that for detecting the atoms and things like that. But it's also among other applications, it's also where we use where we'll launch the atoms up into the 100-meter shaft. So this is a zoomed-in version of the 100-meter shaft, and so you can see some magnetic shielding on the outside above and below this connection node chamber. And so the way the launch works, so if I kind of remove the shield here and look inside that vacuum chamber, we have some in vacuum optics, and there's these scaffolds that extend up and down by about half a meter, and there's some mirrors up top, and this lets us bring in laser beams along this sort of crisscross pattern. You can see a red and a blue beam that are intersecting in the middle here, and where the beams intersect, we have a standing wave or an optical lattice that we use to launch the atom. So there's sort of a diamond-shaped intersection region there where we have an optical lattice, and by controlling the frequency of these red and blue beams, we can accelerate those atoms at like 100 G and launch them up into the upper part of the chamber. We have a couple of other things to worry about. So there's the Coriolis deflection can be quite substantial for these really long drop times. You can see a picture of that here. So this is versus time, the sort of the transverse position of the atom cloud. So if you launch the atom up, it doesn't just follow a one-dimensional path. It actually gets it looks like it deflects in the lab frame due to the Coriolis force. And you can see that in sort of this shown in millimeters here. Our baseline plan is to do sort of 10-meter scale launches, and so you get a sort of a modest Coriolis deflection, not too big. But in principle, you could imagine launching atoms from the bottom of the shaft 100 meters up, which I think would be really inspiring to do that and watch sort of up to 9-second freefall time. We're not sure if we can do that. That's our stretch goal. But if you were to launch an atom 100 meters, then the Coriolis deflection is a decent chunk of a centimeter, sort of side to side. So that's a substantial thing you have to account for. And so to minimize that, we can launch essentially at the appropriate angle so that we sort of come back to where we start. And that's all built into this design where we can tune the launch angle sort of as we need as a function of the launch height. Another really critical part is the magnetic shielding, which I already showed briefly. This is sort of a top view, kind of cross-section of the Magus vacuum system. So there's the vacuum system's on the inside. That's this this flange you're looking at, and then we surround that with an octagon-shaped magnetic shield. And I'm happy to talk about why it's shaped like an octagon. It has some technical advantages for building it, and it's, so you can see sort of multiple layers of mu metal sandwiched together to make the shield. We have to apply a horizontal magnetic field, a bias field, to get the atomic physics to work right. And so for that, we have some vertical currents running along the length of the 100-meter shaft. So that's a series of bias bars, and they provide this horizontal magnetic field. And you can take advantage of the fact that you have this mu metal surrounding it, this magnetic shield. Basically, you get image currents due to that to that shield material, and you can arrange the location of the currents to sort of maximize the uniformity of this field, taking advantage of those image currents to help make that very, very uniform magnetic field where the atoms, because the atoms are only going to be in the very, very middle of that, and we want the field to be uniform. So you can see some early simulations of that work. And so this is quite far along, and as if I have time, I'll show you the sort of the prototype shield that we've been building and testing at Stanford. And then finally, I wanted to mention, I mentioned the Coriolis force already once, so this is sort of another impact of that. The fact that the Earth is rotating is actually really inconvenient for these experiments, so we have to deal with this. And so at the bottom of the 100-meter shaft, we have this special mirror that's inside the vacuum chamber. So you can see a cross section of that chamber here, and here's the mirror at the bottom. And so the light, we send light along the vertical axis to drive the atom interferometers. We want pulses that can come from the bottom, from the top, and from the bottom. And so the way we do that is with this retroreflective mirror. So we bounce the light off the mirror. But since the Earth is rotating, you can get Coriolis forces causing phase shifts in the atom interferometer. It looks like another inertial force, and those phase shifts can cause all sorts of trouble. And so to suppress that, we actually rotate this mirror in the direction opposite to the rotation rate of the Earth, so that the laser beam, instead of rotating with the Earth, the laser beam remains inertially pointing. And so there's some piezo actuators on this mirror, and the mirror just sort of rasters back and forth every time we drop atoms, so it's always rotating at the rotation rate of the Earth. And so that's what that system looks like. I should show sensitivity before I wind up. Actually, how's time looking? A couple minutes, so wrapping up. Yeah, so I think I can wrap up pretty quickly. It's getting to be lunch, so I don't want to hold you all too much. But I think I'll show just a few more slides on sensitivity. So very briefly, so this is the expected gravitational wave sensitivity versus frequency. So you can see the LIGO detector here. And so we expect to be able to do better than any detector has done in this mid-band range, ultimately getting down to the level shown here in blue with sort of a series of upgrades in the atomic physics, which I'll mention in a minute. So this is the band of range we would hope to explore over the years, improving as we go. And as I said, we don't expect this to be sensitive enough to detect gravitational waves, but we can start to test out building a detector of this scale and scaling up a number of the features of the atomic physics to bring us down to lower sensitivities. In terms of dark matter, you can see sort of some projected exclusion plots that you could make, sort of the search space for two different styles of dark matter. So this is a scalar dark matter coupled to the mass of the electron, showing the bounds that you could set, or you could look for dark matter in this unexplored region beyond some what the EP tests have done, as a function of either the frequency, the Compton frequency of the dark matter particle, or the mass. And so you can see we're sort of in the sort of 10 to the minus 14 EV level in terms of so very, very low, very, very weak masses, or excuse me, very, very light masses that we would see in this experiment. And then this is an example of a vector coupled particle. We can also look for vector couplings. This would be for a B minus L coupling. And you can see here, we also have a range of different exclusions we could set. You know, the bands of these depend on sort of how aggressive we are in some of the atomic physics stuff, like how many momentum, how much momentum we can transfer to the atom during the sequence. You can also imagine eventually doing these detectors in space. Space has the advantage of allowing you to really increase the baseline a lot more. And so we've done some thinking, very preliminary, theoretical exploration of what about having a space-based version of this concept. And the advantage there, which I'll just point out, would be compared to like a LISA-like configuration, you could imagine just having two spacecraft along a single baseline, with the single baseline idea that I've been describing. And so this is kind of a cartoon of what that might look like, and the kind of sensitivity you can get in a space slice detector with this very long baseline is shown here. So you can see once again in this mid-band range between LIGO and LISA, there's a couple different modes we can run this in, sort of a broadband mode shown in black, and also in brown here is a resonant detection mode where we run the atom interferometer with a multiple loop geometry and sort of zoom in on a specific frequency. And this shows you sort of how good you could do at any given frequency that you decide to zoom in on. So the nice thing about space version of this is that it really relaxes the sort of atomic physics constraints that you need to do, how hard you have to work on manipulating the atom. The disadvantage is you have to go into space, which is much harder. So I think both of these are interesting directions, sort of scaling up to a kilometer scale on Earth, and also potentially going in space. And we see MAGES 100 as kind of a pathfinder to either of these two directions. And so maybe I'll end on this. Well, I can show you the I think I won't end on this. So this is kind of the details of what we have to do. Enhancements, if people are interested, I'm happy to talk through sort of how the technology evolution path we would like to see. But I did want to just show off some of the progress in 1 minute of what things are looking like in the, for the prototype. So we're building this 10-meter strontium tower. I already showed it in the neutrality experiment at the beginning. But we've already built two of the strontium sources. These are functional. These are the atom sources. And we've been building a section of Magus to test out, like a prototype section. We've been making two of these, actually. As you can see, an early version of that here with the vacuum pipe and then with the magnetic shield installed. And so you can, and we did some preliminary shield characterization. So after building the shield, you put a little magnetometer and run it back and forth. And sort of the preliminary result, this is early data, not completely finished yet, still working on the degaussing of the shield. But we were able to see uniformity at the level already better than we need, sort of at the sort of milligauss level. So with that, I think I will stop and see if anybody has questions. So thanks so much for your attention.
All right, thanks for the very informative talk. So I'm asking a very basic question. I would imagine the atomic clocks have some kind of frequency, and there's no way to measure a signal faster than this frequency. So I'm wondering if this the thing that's limiting the bandwidth of your detection.
Yeah, the bandwidth is limited by how quickly we can sample. So if you make, you have to cool an atom cloud down to prepare. You have to collect the atoms, cool them down, and then launch them, let's say. And that takes, there's some cadence to that. And that repetition rate would set sort of your rate of, so each one of those clouds you produce, you launch, you make an atom interferometer, you detect the atoms, that's one phase shift measurement. And we're looking for a variation in the phase due to gravitational waves or dark matter. And so every point on that curve is going to take some time to produce. Let's say it takes a second to make an atom cloud. So 1 hertz repetition rate. So you would normally not be able to see, you wouldn't expect to be able to see things at higher frequencies. You're just sort of limited by the Nyquist sort of rate there. So that would be the what sets the upper limit on that. Now there are ways of increasing that bandwidth, so we can imagine going as high as maybe 3 to 10 hertz in various ways. But ultimately, that's what I would say sets the upper frequency limit for watching a coherent signal evolve. It's just the sampling rate.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks for the great talk.
I'm sorry, Alex. Yeah. First, sorry, Marcus. Yeah.
Thanks for the great talk, Jason. I was curious about systematic. If you could say a few words about systematic effects, and specifically maybe gravity gradients and things like that that may affect this, and how much is known, how much is not known, and how much work is going into this.
Yeah, let's see if I can remember that. So the gravity gradients are definitely a systematic we've worried about. There will be gravitational gradient phase shifts in these interferometers. There's gradient across the baseline for a number of reasons. You don't care about a static gravity gradient, and so the way that this effect tends to come in is in kinematic fluctuations, right? So if the trajectory of the atom is not repeatable and it's different in the two sources, then that fluctuation can look like a time varying phase shift, which could show up and look confounding. So. And for that, you want to, try to make the field uniform as much as possible. We have what we have for the gravitational gradient, but controlling the jitter in the position. So it sets a constraint essentially on how well controlled the kinematics have to be. If you don't do anything special, those constraints don't look too bad, but they can be somewhat concerning. If that ends up being like the limiting factor, one way to suppress that is to use a higher order pulse sequence. So rather than just a single loop, like I was showing, like a single diamond three pulse sequence, where you're sensitive to gravity gradients, I showed an example of a double diamond sequence yesterday, where based on the time weighting of those sequences, you can selectively suppress different derivatives of the potential. So you can become insensitive to the gravity gradient induced phase error in that case. But then you go to the next derivative of the gravity gradient. So you you would be looking at another derivative of the time varying gravitational wave or dark matter field. So it starts to become more of a resonant detector in that. And it looks like, I think, in the most conservative case, we've thought of doing like a five pole sequence, so like a three diamond loop, and that makes you insensitive to both the velocity and position induced jitter of due to gravity gradient. So I would say sort of the five pole sequence would be the fallback if the position jitter and velocity jitter aren't as good as we're trying to design them to be good enough where you don't worry. But yeah, great question.
So I have a technical question, and I apologize if you had answered it already and I missed it, on the sensitivity curves when you compared to the LIGO performance.
Yeah.
So
this one.
Yeah. No, the next. Yeah, exactly that one. Mm-hmm. So the low frequency sensitivity of LIGO is typically limited by seismic noise. Mm-hmm. So how do you avoid that in that frequency band?
Excellent. Yeah. So the main idea is just you're absolutely right. So the LIGO. This sort of rapid loss or increase in noise in LIGO is due to the fact that their vibration isolation states start to not work so well. That's below the frequency of their pendulums. And in the case of the atom interferometer, the test masses, they're in free fall, so they're not isolated they're not hanging off a pendulum, and so that if you like lowers the natural frequency even more. So we're basically. So the very very short answer is that we're in free fall, so we don't have vibrational noise. That's a bit too quick because, of course, the laser is not in free fall. The laser is shaking, and so there the seismic noise or the vibration noise, it gets encoded onto the phase of the light. But that actually is very similar. It's really identical to intrinsic fluctuations of the laser phase, which I was talking about earlier. So whatever phase the light has, either due to intrinsic laser noise or due to vibration noise, that laser phase will get in principle encoded on the two atoms in the gradiometer in a common way. So it's suppressed to leading order by the differential measurement. Now, even that's too quick because seismic noise also can couple to the atoms gravitationally, as you may know, there's sort of this so-called Newtonian noise, gravity gradient noise. That's what this orange band here is, GGN. And so what that is essentially the seismic noise corresponds to actually shaking dirt, right? There's stuff nearby that's moving, and the local Newtonian potential or gravitational field from that is fluctuating, and that leads to a signal that leads to noise that LIGO has thought about and tends to not limit them yet, but might limit them at some point, and would eventually limit probably any terrestrial gravitational wave detector, including the atoms, because we aren't shielding that. The there are a couple of tricks you can play. One being the fact that we have three sources. So I mentioned that we have this source in the middle, which is not naively needed for the Mages configuration. The reason for the third source is that you can now essentially make a curvature measurement. You can measure at three different points rather than just at two. And in principle, as this is a function of wavelength, of course, but in principle, Newtonian noise has a different spatial dependence than a gravitational wave. A gravitational wave is a planar excitation. It would be uniform across the baseline, whereas a local like point mass, for example, would have a 1 over r squared gravitational field. And so if you have three sources, you can start to maybe distinguish by looking at the correlations along the length. And so we imagine at the kilometer scale to actually instrumenting the baseline with maybe 10 or more atom sources regularly spaced, so you can look at higher derivatives of the potential, and then the idea would be to try to correlate that with the noise you're seeing to try to subtract to some degree. And how well that will work is an open question. We would like to try to get a factor of 10 if we in the most to bring this down by maybe a factor of 10, but it's a very poor scaling with frequency. So I would say below a small fraction of a hertz, it looks very difficult to do terrestrial gravitational wave detection. And that's the other reason why we would want to go for a satellite mission and get away from the shaking test mat. So.
No, thanks a lot. And congrats on this amazing progress.
Thanks for the question. Yeah, Giorgio? Giorgio? Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm preempting. You should be. Please. Okay, go. Yeah.
So you have individual launches, but if you're talking about 100 meter or some futuristic kilometer launch scale, the time that it spends in the launch is many seconds. The frequency
Sorry, is what?
Like many seconds.
Oh, in the launch.
Yeah. Like any individual atom. Okay, yeah. But the frequencies you're looking at are Hertz scale, yeah. So right. Like, why yeah, so is that not a big problem?
Good. No, absolutely it is. So in fact, the longest launch is not what we'd be aiming to do. So imagine sort of like a few meter launch on each end. For the so there's a few, the mages can run in like four different modes for different science, and there is one mode where we'd like to launch atoms for 100 meters or as long as we can, and that would be really good for running a dual isotope, you know, with one atom source, launch two different kinds of atoms from the bottom and look at differential accelerations as a dark matter probe. That's one mode. But for gravitational waves, what we'd be looking at is having, you know, atoms separated by as large as we can, so maybe the top and the bottom atom source you'd be using, and doing like shorter launches. And there you'd want about a second of free fall time, maybe, so you can look in this, because the free fall time is about the frequency you can look for. But either way, your point is valid, right? So if it's about a second, and I'm looking for a second period things, I need to sample more than that. And so to make this work, you want to actually run more than one interferometer at the same time. And so that's one of the reasons why, I didn't spend too much time, but the lattice launch, you can actually see, you know, why we're using this complicated crisscross pattern, rather than just send a beam along the axis and just launch them with the lattice along the vertical pipe. This way, we can by using the cross geometry, we can launch the sources without perturbing the main baseline. Right, so that allows us to launch an atom cloud and start doing atom interferometry, and while the atom while we're doing interferometry, bring in another atom cloud and launch it. So we can do, and so the goal in MAGES 100 is to do two or four simultaneous atom interferometers staggered in time to up the repetition rate. And that sort of multiplexing is something people have thought a little bit about, but it's another one of the kind of Pathfinder type activities that we're planning to study in MAGES, like how to implement that. There's a number of challenges associated with it, but you want to do some amount of multiplexing to do this.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So this is related to Marcus' question earlier about seismic noise. Does the satellite have to be drag-free, or is it just the atom that is drag-free?
Yeah. In the best version, the satellite would not have to be drag-free. And so, if you look at what does that mean? So, in LISA, the idea of what drag-free means is that in LISA, you have some proof mass, macroscopic proof mass, that you're basically ranging between with a laser, and the way that you keep those inertial, you can't just let them fall nightly, because the spacecraft is getting pushed around by all sorts of external forces, you know, the solar radiation pressure, all kinds of stuff. And so what they do is they actually essentially fly the satellite around the proof mass in a way to keep the proof mass inertial. So it's like a shell protecting the proof mass. And this is called a drag-free control system. That's what at least the Pathfinder has tested already as a thing that works at the level that they need. So it's an established technology, but the reason I think Giorgio asked is a challenging thing to do, and if you don't have to do it, it might be nice. The atom, you know, wouldn't have the same requirements as that we have. We could get around having a drag-free proof mass, we think. The reason you might consider it is due to the gravity gradient coupling. That's the most substantial source of noise is as the spacecraft is vibrating around. If it's not drag-free, or if the spacecraft is shut, then you could worry about gravitational fluctuations. But it looks like that they could be small enough that you wouldn't have to worry, unlike the sort of LIGO. LISA constraints. So ideally a non-drag-free control. But I should mention there's a very nice proposal to use atomic optical lattice clocks to do a gravitational wave detector in space, where you just put a lattice clock in two spacecraft and laser range between them. In that case, since the atoms are rigidly connected to the optical lattice, the atom is no longer a proof mass. It is now, you know, rigidly connected to the frame of the satellite. And so it has the advantage of being, you don't have these, you know, recoiling atoms like we have to worry about. Like they're just staying right where you put them in the lattice. But now you would need to add to that sort of a LISA-like drag-free control system so that the lattice mirrors or whatever's generating the optical lattice is a drag-free thing. So in other words, an optical lattice-based approach has a good clock, but it doesn't have a good inertial reference. It needs a GRS. It needs a LISA-like gravitational reference system, like a drag-free proof mass, in addition to the atom. Now, the freely falling atoms would kind of do both all at once, in principle, in the most optimistic version.
So I have a question related to the space stuff. So, you know, today we monitor the flow of water via, you know, atomic clocks and from space.
Yeah.
Does that, you know, the changing of where the water is on the Earth, are you sampling at high enough rate that you can ignore that? You can ignore you know, tides, hurricanes, whatever, that changes the gravity field.
Right. So the question is, do we have to, I guess the question is, was in the context of, do we have to worry about these effects?
Are you sampling so often in time relative to the rate at which water flows that you don't have to worry about?
It's mostly that. It's mostly a frequency that it's at a different rate. But the question is that variations in the water table, or you know, just the tides of the earth, the daily fluctuations in the local gravitational acceleration, those signals are definitely visible at this level of precision, and they can be detected with atom interferometers, and so you might worry about them in the context of these experiments. The answer is a couple of things. First of all, we're looking at a gradiometer, so it would be any different. That already suppresses it to some level, but gradients could still be varying. And so then, if there's a time variation in such signals, it would be at a different frequency range typically. But I would generally put that in the category of like gravity gradient noise, like that's sort of fluctuations in the local, in the environment of the Earth, and as we were saying, that can limit these atom interferometers. So typically it's vibration noise, but so I think in the frequency range we care about, it's going to be mostly seismic noise. But turning it around, those sorts of signals, as you know, are very interesting, and so you could use atom interferometers potentially in a GRACE-like configuration to do water table monitoring. But we would consider that a background in the context of the fundamental physics tests.
Thanks for the talk. Over such long fall times, how worried
are
you?
Sorry, I missed it.
I'm here.
Sorry.
Over such long fall times, how worried are you about the magnetic field fluctuations of the Earth for the atoms?
Magnetic field fluctuations of the Earth?
Yeah.
And the question is how much of a concern?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if the Earth's magnetic field is fluctuating, it could cause a time-varying Zeeman shift on the atoms. So we would worry about that. That could be a problem, absolutely. But there's a number of suppressions that can help with that one. So there's the magnetic shield that we're using, first of all, to try to protect ourselves from the Earth magnetic field. There's the fact that if the Earth's fluctuating, you know, the Earth field is fairly uniform across the length of it can be locally varying, so the background field will certainly not necessarily be the same in the two locations of the atom, so that's not a huge suppression. But those fluctuations are once again out of band. If they're at a lower frequency than we're looking, then we wouldn't worry. But if there were a fluctuating magnetic field at 1 hertz, and we were trying to look for a 1 hertz gravitational wave, that would be a problem. And so those sorts of considerations set their design requirement on the magnetic shield, and it has to do with how susceptible the atom is to magnetic field. As a fallback, what we can also say is that with strontium 87, the atom we plan to use for this study, it has I equals 9/2 nuclear spin. So it has odd half integer spin. So you have plus and minus 9/2 states. There's no m equals zero state, unlike in some other atoms where we like to put the atoms if we can in an m equals zero internal state to reduce the Zeeman shift. In the case of strontium 87, you can't do that. So we have a linear Zeeman shift, or rather than just a quadratic Zeeman shift, which is worse. However, it's small in strontium because it's a nuclear rather than electric response. So it's not as bad as I'm saying. But what the plan is to do is to use two different spin states, so a plus 9/2 and minus 9/2 m state simultaneously. So what you can do is, so you run these simultaneous interferometers in two different Zeeman sublevels, and then you can then average those two and get rid of the magnetic field to get rid of the linear response. But however, the fact that you have two means that you have a sum and a difference. So you actually have a co-magnetometer present. So you can actually measure the local magnetic field instantaneously on each shot with that configuration. So you have a suppression and you have the ability to measure and potentially subtract further if you want. So there's a number of mitigations, but certainly magnetic fields are one of the biggest concerns. And one of the reasons why I'm really excited that we're using these alkaline earth atoms that have sort of paired up electronic spin, so they have a thousand times smaller magnetic response than the sort of single active electron atoms like rubidium. So that's a huge leverage that we have. But in addition, we take these other precautions. Otherwise, the dark matter thing looks like an energy shift. Time varying Zeeman shift would look completely confounding. So we have to worry very carefully about magnetic fields. Yeah.
So I have a question about the drag-free environment that we have in LISA-like missions.
Yeah.
So there we have like So in current LISA-like missions, we have the GRS, gravitational reference systems, which are based on electronic feedback and stuff like that. I wonder if we try to do these kind of experiment with atoms, what kind of control and feedback systems we intend to use to keep the drag-free environment.
Right. Well, so I guess the question is how you would implement a drag-free control system using an atom test mass. Right? Yeah, was the question. Yeah. Maybe the dodge answer would be that I don't want to have to do that because I want to make my atom insensitive enough that I don't have to worry about that. But you might have to. And so I guess what you could do would be to use the same approach that's used in LISA, so where you have a sort of a classical proof mass that you're monitoring. You know, with capacitive readout, for example, or whatever, find out where it is, and then apply sort of feedback to fly around that, which is how the GRS works, and then the atom could just be benefiting from that drag-free environment that you're producing. It could just be distinct from the proof mass that's providing the drag-free control. I wouldn't want to necessarily monitor the atom to do that, right? For a number of reasons, but. You're learning about, you know, every measurement you make, every phase shift you make is in fact sampling where the atom is with respect to the sensor cage, right? Where you know the laser is, you know, with respect to the frame, you know, what the phase of the, you know, where the atom is with respect to that via the laser's phase. And so, you know, spectral, you know, sort of stroboscopically, you're measuring that atom location. Maybe you could use that as part of the feedback algorithm. But I think, you know, this is me just off the cuff. It would seem more natural to just do a traditional drag-free control approach if you needed it. And so that, and I think that's what we would say it would be the approach, or what I would say the approach would be, with the nice result that the requirements would be what would be much less than LISA in ideally, because you're not using that drag-free proof mass as the actual test mass for the measurement. That's not your inertial reference. The atom is still your inertial reference. You would just be using this GRS kind of to keep the satellite from vibrating too much. So that it doesn't have fluctuating gravitational fields that are hurting you. So I think it could be orders of magnitude less difficult than LISA is the main takeaway from this. And once again, two spacecraft instead of three. So I think there's a number of advantages to consider this technology, clocks or atom interferometers, with different trade-offs between those two that are worth considering for this mid-band range in space.
Okay, so let's thank Jason again. We go to launch.